and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Tuesday, May 26th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakrose. North Iowa Fair canceled. Another summer staple has been decommissioned by ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. The North Iowa Fair Board of Directors announced that the 2020 North Iowa Fair, set for July 16th, would be canceled due to continued health and safety concerns. In a letter, North Iowa Fair Board Vice President Scott Miller wrote that the decision was made after much discussion and deliberation and consultation with the Cerro Gordo County Department of Public Health. The Board of Directors' decision was difficult for all concerned, but ultimately was necessary in order to ensure the health and well-being of all who attend and support the North Iowa Fair, Miller wrote. While all physical events at the fairgrounds have been canceled, Miller did say that the fair would allow for all 4-H events to be presented virtually or in accordance with whatever guidelines may be set by the Cerro Gordo County Extension Office. The announcement comes the same day that the city of Clear Lake declared that its 5-day celebration for the 4th of July had been canceled due to COVID-19. That announcement was made in a press conference with Clear Lake, Cerro Gordo Public Health, and chamber officials. On May 11th, the Mason City Municipal Band shared on Facebook that its season also would not happen because of the pandemic. The decision came almost a month after the Mason City Chamber of Commerce Board of Directors moved to cancel the 82nd North Iowa Band Festival planned for Memorial Day weekend. Along with summertime events such as the Clear Lake celebrations and the North Iowa Fair, summer destinations in Cerro Gordo County have also been nixed. On May 13th, Mason City officials announced that they had decided to not prepare the pools to open to the public this summer. In making the announcement, City Administrator Aaron Burnett said that a major factor in the decision was that the levels of public gathering that take place at pools make it impossible to safely open at this time. Clear Lake's 2020 4th of July celebration events canceled. For decades, tens of thousands of people have gathered in downtown Clear Lake to celebrate the 4th of July, but that won't be the case this year. Officials with the City of Clear Lake, Clear Lake Area Chamber of Commerce, and 4th of July Celebration Committee announced with the heaviest of hearts Tuesday afternoon that the 5-day celebration scheduled July 1st through the 5th has been canceled due to COVID-19. Although some restrictions are beginning to ease, there are still too many uncertainties to ensure without hesitation the health and safety of our community and the 100,000-plus visitors who come to Clear Lake for the 5-day event, Clear Lake Mayor Nelson Crabb said. Additionally, with the social distancing restrictions on festivals and mass gatherings, it is simply not possible to move forward. We know that the 4th of July celebration is a long-standing Clear Lake tradition, but given the reality of COVID-19, our highest priority is the health and safety of our guests, participants, staff, volunteers, and our community. The announcement, which was made in collaboration with Cerro Gordo County Public Health, was live-streamed on the City of Clear Lake YouTube channel and Clear Lake Area Chamber of Commerce Facebook page. Clear Lake Area Chamber of Commerce President and CEO Stacy Dugan said members of the Chamber Board, 4th of July Celebration Committee, and City have been meeting weekly to evaluate the situation, the governor's proclamation, and recommendations from local health officials. It just became clear that there was simply no way to social distance at a celebration that draws tens of thousands of people to Clear Lake, she said. We know this is extremely disappointing. We, too, are extremely disappointed. Historically, the annual celebration has featured a parade, carnival, live entertainment, outdoor arts and crafts fair, food vendors, and fireworks over the lake. The 4th of July Celebration Committee is exploring ways to safely hold some of the canceled activities later this year, including the fireworks, Dugan said. She said the committee is also considering an alternate location for this year's 4th of July fireworks that would allow spectators to remain in their vehicles while watching. More details will be forthcoming. On Tuesday, Governor Kim Reynolds signed a new proclamation continuing the state public health emergency declaration. Under her proclamation, gatherings or events like parades, festivals, conventions, or fundraisers of more than 10 people may be held effective June 1st and continuing until June 17th as long as they meet capacity limitations of 50% at indoor and outdoor venues, ensure social distancing of those attending, and other public health measures to reduce the spread of COVID-19. Clear Lake City Administrator Scott Florey said the logistics alone make it impossible to have things like parades, carnivals, and fireworks while following local, state, and federal public health guidelines. Certainly, Clear Lake will still be a destination for the 4th of July weekend. We know that, Florey said. We encourage people who celebrate the 4th of July to do so responsibly. He, along with others present, encouraged those who reside and visit Clear Lake to support its local economy and its businesses during this difficult time in our country and state and community's history, because they need it more than ever. We know this announcement will disappoint many. We ourselves are heartbroken to have to make this announcement, Crabb said. However, we'll be back in 2021 stronger and better than ever. Reynolds opens more businesses, entertainment venues. Governor Kim Reynolds announced plans Tuesday to open up more businesses and entertainment venues next week, including casinos and gambling facilities, speedways and raceways with spectators in attendance, along with amusement parks, bowling alleys, pool halls, and arcades, but under certain restrictions as the state adjusts to life during the coronavirus pandemic. Iowa is on the road to recovery, the governor told her daily briefing at the state's Emergency Operations Center in Johnston. For our state, recovery means striking a balance between getting life and business back to normal while continuing to manage the virus activity. Our recovery is contingent on our ability to protect the life and livelihood of Iowans. We can't prioritize one over the other. We must prioritize both to move forward, the governor said. To that end, Reynolds said she is extending her existing public health emergency proclamation through June 25th, but with changes. She already announced that beginning May 28th, bars, wineries, breweries, distilleries, and other social and fraternal clubs can reopen under the same public health restrictions as restaurants have functioned with since May 1st, including social distancing of 6 feet and 50% of operating capacity. Live bands or other musical performers will be permitted at bars and restaurants, but they must also follow social distancing protocols with band members and the audience. Restaurants and bars also can set party sizes of up to 10 people. Effective next Monday, June 1st, speedways and raceways may reopen to spectators, the governor said, and outdoor performance venues such as amphitheaters and grandstands can hold live performances. Also, casinos and gaming facilities may reopen June 1st, as well as amusement parks, bowling alleys, pool halls, and arcades, all at 50% of normal operating capacity and according to social distancing, hygiene, and public measures. The governor also announced that social, community, recreational, leisure, and sports gatherings of more than 10 people will be permitted again beginning June 1st, with 6 feet social distancing and venues limited to 50% or levels necessary to maintain social distancing. She said the change permits practices, games, and competition for youth and adult baseball and softball, as well as individual sports such as running, swimming, biking, tennis, and golf, to resume with appropriate social distancing and hygiene. Lifting this restriction means extended families and friends can gather together, but that privilege comes with responsibility of ensuring you are doing the right thing to protect your health and the health of the people you care about, Reynolds said. The governor noted that a moratorium on residential foreclosures and evictions will end June 1st, but the state is formulating an assistance plan to be announced later this week to help Iowans who may be adversely impacted by the order. Reynolds made the announcement on a day when Iowa's death count in the coronavirus outbreak stood at 471. Sarah Gordo's daily COVID-19 update. More businesses to reopen. Tuesday, May 26th, data snapshot. 17,658 total lab-confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Iowa. 22 total lab-confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Cerro Gordo. 471 deaths in Iowa. 1 death in Cerro Gordo. 3,247 COVID-19 tests administered at the mobile testing unit. a status report of monitoring and testing of COVID-19 in Iowa, including county-level data provided by the Iowa Department of Public Health, can be found at coronavirus.iowa.gov. Governor Reynolds extends disaster proclamation and allows additional businesses to reopen. At today's press conference, Governor Kim Reynolds stated she is extending the current disaster proclamation through June 25th and allowing more businesses to reopen. As of June 1st, speedways, amphitheaters, casinos, bowling alleys, theme parks, and arcades may reopen at 50% capacity. Reynolds also announced that sports gatherings of more than 10 people may resume as long as proper public health measures are practiced. At a statewide moratorium on foreclosures, evictions, and other debt collection activities is set to expire Wednesday, May 27th. To view the governor's disaster proclamations, visit coronavirus.iowa.gov/pages/proclamations. Drowning prevention tips for parents as many families by pools or visit lakes. Since most public pools are not opening this summer due to COVID-19, many parents are buying backyard pools and visiting local natural bodies of water. We all want to keep our children safe and secure and help them live to their full potential. Knowing how to prevent leading causes of child injury, like drowning, is a step toward this goal. When most of us are enjoying time at the pool or beach, injuries are not the first thing on our minds. Yet drownings are a leading cause of injury death for young children ages 1 to 14, and 3 children die every day because of drowning. In fact, drowning kills more children ages 1 to 4 than anything else except birth defects. Thankfully, parents can play a key role in protecting the children they love from drowning. Below is a list of tips for parents to keep in mind to prevent drownings. Learn life-saving skills. Everyone should know the basics of swimming, floating, moving through the water, and cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR. Fence it off. Install a 4-sided isolation fence with self-closing and self-latching gates around backyard swimming pools. This can help keep children away from the area when they aren't supposed to be swimming. Pool fences should completely separate the house and play area from the pool. Make life jackets a must. Make sure kids wear life jackets in and around natural bodies of water, such as lakes or the ocean, even if they know how to swim. Life jackets can be used in and around pools for weaker swimmers, too. Be on the lookout. When kids are in or near water, including bathtubs, closely supervise them at all times. Because drowning happens quickly and quietly, adults watching kids in or near water should avoid distracting activities like playing cards, reading books, talking on the phone, and using alcohol or drugs. There is no evidence that the virus that causes COVID-19 can be spread to people through the water in pools, hot tubs, spas, or water play areas. Proper operation and maintenance, including disinfection with chlorine and bromine, of these facilities should inactivate the virus in the water. Limit close contact with people who are not part of your household, both in and out of the water. For more information on drowning prevention, visit cdc.gov. Mosquitoes, flies, and ticks cannot transmit COVID-19. To date, there has been no information nor evidence to suggest that the new coronavirus could be transmitted by mosquitoes, according to the World Health Organization. The new coronavirus is a respiratory virus which spreads primarily through droplets generated when an infected person coughs or sneezes, or through droplets of saliva or discharge from the nose. To protect yourself from COVID-19, clean your hands frequently with an alcohol-based hand rub or wash them with soap and water. Also, avoid close contact with anyone who is coughing and sneezing. To protect yourself from vector-borne diseases, use an Environmental Protection Agency registered insect repellent with one of the active ingredients below. When used as directed, EPA-registered insect repellents are proven safe and effective, even for pregnant and breastfeeding women. And the active ingredients are DEET, picaridin, known as KBR 3023, and icaridin outside the U.S., IR3535, oil of lemon eucalyptus, paramethanediol, 2-undecanone. For more information on how to prevent tick and mosquito bites, visit cdc.gov. Cerro Gordo County Board of Supervisors approves budget amendment for $3 million in added spending. The Tuesday morning meeting for the Cerro Gordo County Board of Supervisors was a morning for budget amendments. Along with the second amendment to the county's fiscal year 2020 budget, the three-member panel also heard an agenda item for amending the engineering department's own budget. In total, board members Casey Callanan, Tim Latham, and Chris Watts approved $3,496,000 in amended expenditures and $2,055,000 in amended revenues for a net negative of $1,444,000. According to Cerro Gordo County Budget Manager Heather Mathery, the primary reason for expenditure changes is work on the engineering department's new secondary road building, which is listed at $1,689,686. Along with the building work, there's an amended $454,025 for Cerro Gordo County Public Health and Cerro Gordo County Juvenile Detention and Probation, and $100,000 toward the local Small Business Recovery and Continuity Fund. On the revenue side, the county took in $512,126 for sale of property near the North Iowa Fairgrounds to Quickstar for a third Mason City location. The largest loss contributor was a net negative of $308,554 for Cerro Gordo County Public Health and a net negative of $286,700 for reimbursements to county social services. Until this year, Cerro Gordo County paid employees of CSS and was then reimbursed. Now that CSS has become its own employer, that revenue has gone off the books. It's a wash then because we just take it in and give it to them, as Latham characterized the change. As Mathery pointed out, the budget amendment is the second of the year after $2 million in amendments were approved in January. At that time, the budget amendments largely dealt with secondary roads plans and programs, including $80,000 for work on the courthouse parking lot, $180,000 for secondary roads, and $1,055,000 for the secondary roads building. Other projects have been amended out and will likely be seen on subsequent budgets. Cannonball Day in Mason City postponed. Joining the ranks of many other summer activities in North Iowa, Cannonball Day is being pushed back to later this summer, August 29th. The annual Cannonball Day event, started by the Friends of the 457 more than a decade ago, highlights the Minneapolis and St. Louis steam locomotive in Mason City's East Park. The Friends of the 457 started Cannonball Day to fund the restoration and preservation of the M&N St. L. 457, a 1912 steam engine better known as the Rotary Cannonball. The Friends' mission for Cannonball Day is to provide a day promoting healthy living and lifestyles for kids. The Lion Kiwanis Cannonball Chicken Barbecue is also postponed to that date. The Rotary Cannonball will not open until August 1st. For more information about Cannonball Day and the Friends of the 457, visit friendsofthe457.org. Patience, preparation are key to successful drug investigations. The Cerro Gordo County Jail has seen a barrage of inmates whose charges include drug-related offenses. According to Cerro Gordo County Sheriff's Chief Deputy David Hepperly, a lot of drug arrests stem from other infractions, such as traffic violations. But a good number of them also come as the result of extensive investigation, which was the case in a mass arrest sweep last week. On May 18th, 9 arrest warrants were executed in Cerro Gordo County, resulting in 6 arrests. Antonio Ochoa Sandoval, 24, Amber D. Willemborg, 35, Kelsey Renee LeDuc, 21, and Daniel Lee Vavrick, 54, were each arrested and charged with felony drug counts. Arthur Allen Ketchum, 64, and Brian Bartholomew Mathias, 32, are facing misdemeanor charges. 3 felony warrants which did not yield arrests were issued for Jacob Daniel Johnson, 30, who is already in prison serving a federal sentence on unrelated charges, and Timothy Charles Cassidy, 44, and Crystal Pennington, 32, respectively, who each remain at large. Hepperly says the apparent uptick in arrests is not necessarily the result of any pointed efforts by area agencies, and that last week's sweep were the culmination of individual investigations that happened to coincide. Start to finish, a drug investigation is a multifaceted endeavor, one which can take months before an arrest can even be made. There's a lot of different ways these investigations are started, said Hepperly. A lot of times it starts with a complaint from the general public, and that kind of puts somebody on our radar. When a complaint is made, it's cataloged and shared with other state drug enforcement entities, and data on the subject is compiled from there. Investigators that work narcotics frequently meet and share information, Hepperly said. Through these meetings, it may be something I learned in, say, last December, that we have some new information on that came up today and we're able to further investigate because of the new information. Once the collected information rises to the threshold of probable cause, investigators will petition a judge for a search warrant, but getting to that point is not often quick. You know, it's not a perfect world where I get information on a Monday morning and by Monday afternoon I have enough to get a search warrant for a property, said Hepperly. It's usually a long process where it may take weeks to months to have enough information where we're able to go further with it. After warrants are issued, deputies move on to the sometimes disquieting process of executing a search warrant. You can never depend on it going the way you planned. There's just so many different variables that come into play. Every search comes with prudent planning by the agencies involved. Deputies and investigators have a briefing ahead of time to go over the warrant and determine the best strategy for entering the property. Precautions are always taken when subjects who are known to be more volatile are involved. As far as getting ready to execute a warrant, we do have different tools at our disposal. If we have a violent or potentially violent individual or a particular circumstance where there may be, say, weapons involved, we can use the Special Operations Group. Overall, the process is a collaborative one. We also work closely with the North Central Iowa Narcotics Task Force. My investigator spends a lot of time with the investigators assigned to the Drug Task Force, said Hepperly. All of the investigators work together. Fourth Street lane closure starting in Mason City this week. With the construction season now in full swing, Mason City residents need to be on the lookout for the closures, detours, and reroutes that often come along with such work. This week, that means any motorists will need to adjust to a lane closure on 4th Street Southwest near the still-under-construction Talon multi-unit housing complex. According to a release from City Administrator Aaron Burnett, the eastbound portion of 4th Street Southwest to northbound Highway 65 will be closed for storm sewer repairs. This area will remain closed for approximately 1 week, Burnett wrote in the release. Waldorf University to return to face-to-face courses in August. Waldorf University will start up face-to-face classes again on August 24th. President Robert Alsop made the announcement Tuesday morning. The health and safety of our students and employees are our first priority, said Alsop. We are working on safety and contingency plans to ensure we provide a safe and welcoming environment this fall. While our campus operations may look a little different, we are preparing for the return of our warriors in August. There are three committees preparing the institution for the fall semester by crafting operational plans to follow proper guidelines for health testing, screening and tracing, cleaning and sanitizing, social distancing in the classroom, residence halls, and dining services. University leadership is preparing three contingency plans for preparation for fall semester. Each option will provide a safe environment for students, faculty, and staff, strictly following the guidelines provided by community and state health officials. We housed over 100 students that couldn't return home during the spring semester as the COVID-19 outbreak occurred, Alsop said. I would like to thank the faculty, staff, and state and community health officials that made it possible to provide a safe environment to our students that stayed on campus this past spring as we adjusted our operations. The spirit provided by our team and community showed how deeply we care for our warriors. I couldn't be prouder. Portion of Mercy One North Iowa Cancer Center remodel complete. The remodel of the medical oncology suite at Mercy One North Iowa Cancer Center is complete. The second floor suite, which is part of a multi-year, multi-million dollar remodeling project, opened to patients on May 18th. The medical oncology suite features at least 20 examination rooms and 2 procedure rooms. The project, which began in August, will provide additional services, space, and providers to improve the center's care and access for area cancer patients. The cancer center was built nearly 30 years ago to accommodate 2 medical oncologists and 2 radiation oncologists, but due to an increase in patients and services, it has outgrown the space as it was originally designed. Last year, the cancer center saw about 900 new patients from the 14-county area, a number that has increased year after year, and the staff is more than double what it was 3 decades ago, said Cindy Shriver, Cancer Center Director, in February. In 2018, Mercy One North Iowa Cancer Center received a grant from Trinity Health, a not-for-profit corporation for which it's a member, and a private donation to remodel the 3-story building. The project, which is being done in phases, started in August after seeking input from patients, providers, and staff about what they felt was needed at the center. The new lab, including 2 draw stations instead of 1, is done and open, and the pharmacy is due next. After the remodel, the center's first floor will feature an expanded radiation oncology area and infusion area, as well as a new lab, pharmacy, and boutique. The boutique will offer products like hair and skin care that can help patients through their cancer treatments. The infusion center is temporarily located on the 2nd floor of the cancer center to free up space on the 1st floor for the remodel. The infusion area, which is also used to treat non-cancer patients, will increase by 10 treatment chairs to 24. It will also feature areas where patients and their friends and family can socialize with others. Once the infusion center is complete, which is expected for mid-October, there will be a new physical therapy space on the 2nd floor. The 2nd floor will also include an education room that can be used by the center's dietitian for cooking classes geared toward its patients. The cancer center is also adding social worker services, financial counseling, expanded dietitian services, and a physical therapist. The cancer center project is scheduled to be completed in October 2021. Man scheduled for trial in death of Sioux City homeowner. A 45-year-old Carroll Mann is scheduled to go on trial for murder in the death of a Sioux City man whose home he was reportedly trying to burglarize. Gary Daines Jr. has been jailed since last summer on charges of burglarizing the home of Paul Smith, 65, in July. Daines pleaded not guilty last week to first-degree murder and 3 other charges in Smith's death. He is being held on a $1 million bond. On Tuesday, a murder trial was scheduled for October 27th. According to court records, Daines told investigators he had previously stolen items from Smith's home before he returned to the house in July. A fight broke out when Daines told Smith to leave, the Sioux City Journal reported. Daines told police Smith fell to the floor but was breathing when he left with $120 in cash and Smith's Ford Explorer, according to the complaint. An autopsy found Smith died from blunt force injuries and ruled his death a homicide. Reynolds lets foreclosure and eviction moratorium expire, will create housing assistance fund. Governor Kim Reynolds said Tuesday she does not plan to extend a moratorium on home foreclosures and rental evictions, but will instead establish a program to provide financial assistance to Iowans who have lost income and face foreclosure or eviction. Reynolds had ordered a temporary halt on home foreclosures and rental evictions as a part of her administration's response to the global new coronavirus pandemic. The move was to offset the ordered closures of many Iowa businesses, which caused unemployment levels to spike to record highs. That order will expire at the end of Wednesday. Reynolds said Tuesday during her daily briefing on the state's pandemic response efforts that she will not extend the moratorium. Instead, Reynolds said her administration will create a program that will assist Iowans who have lost income due to the pandemic and may be unable to pay their mortgage or rent. The program will be funded by federal money designed for pandemic response efforts and administered by the Iowa Finance Authority, a state agency that operates housing assistance programs. Reynolds said plans are being finalized and that she anticipates the program will be operational by the end of this week. Monday is the first day of the next month when many mortgage and rent payments will be due. We'll take a look at the numbers and take a look at who qualifies. Then we'll set aside the appropriate amount of funding to meet the needs of Iowans during this really difficult time, Reynolds said. We're just changing the parameters in which we're providing the assurance that individuals aren't thrown out of their homes in these really difficult times. You are listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Tuesday, May 26th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Sister Teresa Ann Spitz, RSM. Born June 15, 1930, died May 16, 2020. Sister Teresa Ann Spitz, RSM, 89, died on May 16th at Mercy Hallmar in Cedar Rapids after a brief illness. A private service will be held on May 21st with the burial following at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids by Reverend Anthony Adewu. Memorial services for the family, friends, and the extended community will be celebrated at a later date. Arrangements are with Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services, Cedar Rapids. Teresa Ann was born on June 15, 1930, in Orchard, the daughter of Frank and Bertha Roth Spitz. She attended the public elementary school in Orchard and graduated from Osage Public High School in Osage, after which she entered the Cedar Rapids Mercy Community in 1948 and completed her formal education with a BA degree in English and a minor in education from Mount Mercy College in Cedar Rapids. For 44 years, from 1951 to 1995, Sisters' ministry was teaching in the following schools: St. Wenceslaus, Cedar Rapids; St. Matthew, Kalispell, Montana; Sacred Heart, Waterloo; Sacred Heart, Olwine; St. Patrick, Fairfax; St. Joseph, Marion; St. Patrick, Gary Owen; and St. Joseph in DeWitt. In 1995 at DeWitt, Sister started transitioning into pastoral ministry on a part-time basis until it became her full-time ministry. Sister Teresa Ann supported generations of families until her retirement in 2012. Upon moving back to Cedar Rapids, she was a faithful volunteer at Sacred Heart Convent. Visiting the homebound and residents at care centers, along with her love for gardening, especially plants, to beautify the Sacred Heart campus, were her special interest in her retirement years. Sister enjoyed playing cards and was known for her expertise when playing trivia games. Sister Teresa Ann was a vowed member of the Mercy community for 71 years. In addition to the Sisters of Mercy, Sister Teresa Ann is survived by her sister Geraldine Younger and numerous nieces, nephews, and their extended families. Her parents, Frank and Bertha, and her siblings, Donald, Clarence, and Bernard, preceded Sister in death. Memorials may be sent to the Sisters of Mercy at 1125 Prairie Drive Northeast, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, 52402. Benjamin James Frederick. Born August 14, 1981, died May 22, 2020. Benjamin James Frederick, 38, of Clear Lake, passed away on Friday, May 22. There will be a celebration of life on Thursday, May 28, from 4 to 6 p.m. on the Activity Lawn at Central Gardens, 800 2nd Avenue North in Clear Lake. In compliance with Central Gardens policy, please follow social distancing guidelines and masks are encouraged. We know many of our family and friends are at high risk for COVID-19. Please do not feel you need to attend. Maybe just take a moment to think of a happy time you shared with Ben. Ben was born on August 14, 1981, to Jim Frederick and Mary Malik Lee. He graduated from Clear Lake High School and NIACC. During high school, Ben worked for his uncle Joe Nielsen at Nielsen Electric. This was the start of Ben's career as a journeyman electrician, most recently with Linehan Electric. Ben enjoyed biking, gardening, fishing, kayaking, being outdoors, and helping anyone in need. He was an amazing handyman who could fix just about anything. Ben is survived by his parents, John and Mary Lee, his son, Jackson McEnroy, his brother, Zach Frederick, and spouse Chelsea, and their children, Harlow and Dempsey, his sisters, Allison Hiscox and spouse Don, and their son Andy, Shayna Frederick and her spouse Colin, and Miranda Frederick. He is also survived by his grandma, Alice Malik, and many loving aunts, uncles, cousins, and friends, including his ex-wife and good friend, Sarah Frederick, and her children, Isaac and Bella. He is also survived by stepmothers Marie Frederick and Wendy Engebretson. Ben was preceded in death by his father, Jim Frederick, his parents, Jim and Marge Frederick, Clement Malick and Sam and Marcella Lee, his very special uncle, Joe Nielsen, his aunt, Lori Malick, his niece, Emma Hiscox, and his nephew, Charlie Hiscox. In life, Ben struggled with bipolar disorder and depression. We pray he is now at peace. Linda K. Hartwig, born October 6, 1954, died May 22, 2020. Linda K. Hartwig, 65, of Mason City, passed away Friday, May 22, at Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center. A private family funeral will be held in Linda's honor, and a public celebration of her life will be held at a future date. Burial will be in Rock Grove Cemetery, Norris Springs. The family suggests memorials be directed to the Humane Society of North Iowa. Linda K. McManus was born October 6, 1954, in Norris Springs, the daughter of Marshall and Mabel Robertson McManus. Growing up, Linda attended Norris Springs High School. On October 20, 1970, she married the love of her life, Dennis C. Hartwig, at St. Luke's Lutheran Church in Norris Springs. The couple was blessed with two daughters, Angela and Amber. Linda went on to continue her education at Hamilton Business College. She worked at North Iowa Community Action for 30 years until her retirement in 2019. Linda enjoyed time spent outdoors in the garden and collecting birds and figurines at antique sales. Her two dogs, Sammy and Coco, kept her busy and always put a smile on her face. Linda looked forward to visiting with her siblings. Most of all, time with her beloved grandchildren and great-grandchildren was treasured. She was a dedicated wife, mother, grandmother, great-grandmother, and sister, and will be missed by all. Linda was a longtime member of Bethlehem Lutheran Church in Mason City. Those left to cherish her memory are her husband of 50 years, Dennis, her daughter, Angela Bublitz of Mason City, grandchildren, Cody, Taylor, Carter, and Spencer Bublitz, and Alicia and Michael Adams, great-grandchildren, Noah Fetner, Connor Bublitz, Ella Thompson, River Bruns, and Oakley Lamb, siblings, Shirley Nev, Helen Smith, Carolyn Birding and spouse Roy, Alice Smith, Sandra Prescott, and Michael McManus and spouse Mary, as well as numerous nieces, nephews, and extended family members. Those greeting her at Heaven's Gate are her daughter, Amber Hartwig, a great-grandson, Brighton Thompson, her parents, Marshall and Mabel, a sister, Mary Grauerholtz, and a brother, Norman McManus. Robert Buffalo Bob Virchow, born November 1, 1943, died May 24, 2020. Robert Buffalo Bob Virchow, 76, of rural Glenville, Minnesota, passed away Sunday, May 24th, at his home after a courageous battle. A memorial service to honor Bob will be held 2:30 p.m. Saturday, June 6th, at Connor Colonial Chapel, 1008 First Avenue South in Northwood. The family will greet friends from 1 p.m. until the service time. Bob will be laid to rest at Stateline Cemetery at a later date. Robert Dwayne Virchow was born November 1, 1943, at the family home in Northwood to Russell Harold and Dolores C. Gordon Virchow. Growing up in Northwood, Bob attended the Northwood Community School. Bob farmed in the area for numerous years and worked at Wilson's in Albert Lea. He was most known for his exotic animals and took pride in caring for them. Over the years, Bob raised mountain lions, monkeys, elk, deer, bears, and just about everything in between. He raised buffalo for 47 years, training numerous calves for movie and TV roles. These adventures introduced Bob to many people from all over the world. On February 15, 1999, Bob married his soulmate, Debbie Sturdivant, and together they shared a lifetime worth of adventures. Bob was an energetic ball of excitement. He looked forward to driving teams of ponies and being a part of the wagon train. He enjoyed time at Sturgis and his Harley-Davidson collection. Bob was constantly looking forward to the next animal swap or sale auction and never truly knew what prizes he might come home with. Most of all, Bob loved being a grandpa. Spending time with his grandchildren and great-grandchildren brought him great joy, and he looked forward to watching them play sports all over the area. Those left to cherish his memory are his wife of 21 years, Debbie, his children, Sandra Pearson and spouse Gerald of Hampton, Minnesota, Scott Virchow and spouse Elizabeth of Northwood, Sean Nelson and spouse Tom of Hastings, Minnesota, Todd Virchow and spouse Sue of Garner, Bobby Joe Jacobs and spouse Matt of Alden, Minnesota, Brandy Virchow of Linville, Cody Virchow and spouse Tori of Osceola, Jim Muse and spouse Jennifer of Clarion, and Shauna Prahl and spouse Justin of Clemmie. 18 beloved grandchildren, 12 great-grandchildren, a sister, Donna Nelson of Lake Mills, as well as numerous extended family members and countless friends. Preceding him in death are his parents, Russell and Dolores, a son, Kyle Virchow, a great-grandson, Lawson Strand, and a brother, Donald Virchow. Daughter says Iowa failed to protect her dad, 86, from virus. The daughter of an Iowa nursing home resident who died suddenly in a coronavirus outbreak said Tuesday she believes the state could have done more to stop the spread and protect elderly citizens such as her father. Roger Coe, 86, died Friday at the Crystal Heights Care Center in Oskaloosa after the virus quickly spread through his home. Coe, who served 2 decades in the U.S. Air Force, leaves behind 8 grandchildren and 2 great-grandchildren. The center said Monday that 48 residents and 13 employees have tested positive over roughly the last 2 weeks. 6 residents have died in recent days at the home, which has a capacity of 92. Sherry Coe of Fort Collins, Colorado, said her father was known for wheeling himself to the nurse's station every day and playing his harmonica for anyone who would listen. He learned that he was positive only days before he died. A retired Xerox technician, he had suffered from memory problems, but was otherwise pretty healthy, she said. He was a middle-class guy just trying to make it, Sherry Coe said of her father. What makes me sad the most about it is, in places like Iowa, this didn't have to happen if people would have paid attention. Coe questioned how the virus got inside the home, given that Mahaska County had relatively few cases before the outbreak at Crystal Heights. She noted that Governor Kim Reynolds was among the few who never issued a stay-at-home order and has steadily relaxed public health restrictions over the last month. Coe said that has made her father's death particularly tough to watch because other states did more to protect public health. To me, she's just failed woefully at keeping her constituents safe, Coe said of Reynolds. A spokesman for the governor didn't immediately respond. Reynolds and her administration have defended the steps that the state has taken to protect nursing home residents, while acknowledging they haven't always been enough. They have included closing the facilities to visitors, screening staff before shifts, and sending teams to investigate and conduct testing when positive cases are confirmed. Reynolds said Tuesday that saving lives cannot take priority over protecting people's economic livelihoods, and that both must happen simultaneously. She announced that gatherings of larger than 10 could resume and several more businesses can reopen June 1st. At least 251 residents of long-term care facilities have died of coronavirus across the state, more than half of Iowa's 473 fatalities from COVID-19, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. Outbreaks in which 3 or more residents have been infected have been confirmed at 37 facilities, more than 8% of those statewide. Nearly 1,600 residents and employees have tested positive, comprising 9% of Iowa's cases. Roger Coe grew up in New Sharon and joined the Air Force after graduating from high school in 1951. He later worked for Xerox for many years in Denver and Urbandale before retiring to the Oskaloosa area. He had 3 children with his first wife, who died in 1982 of health problems. He later remarried and divorced. Sherry Coe, a 62-year-old retired beer factory worker, edited her father's obituary to make clear that coronavirus was the cause of death. She said that the deaths of nursing home residents has been treated as insignificant. It's important for people to know what's going on, she said. It's something that we haven't been through in our lifetimes, and I think it's important that we get it right. BNSF Railroad to clean up lead waste at Iowa property. Federal officials say BNSF Railroad has agreed to clean up 2 million pounds of broken glass from televisions and computer monitors that contain lead at a property it bought in Sioux City several years ago. The Environmental Protection Agency says the glass from cathode ray tube monitors was left at the site by a recycling company that owned the land before BNSF bought it in 2014. The EPA says the cleanup will take about 4 months to complete. A BNSF spokeswoman said the railroad didn't know about the hazardous waste at the site when it bought the land. The EPA says the Sioux City site is one of 6 locations in Iowa and Nebraska where Recyclectronics left roughly 16.9 million pounds of glass from CRT monitors behind. The owner of Recyclectronics is awaiting trial on criminal charges for failing to obtain a hazardous waste permit to store the glass. The company maintains that it is unable to pay for the cleanup. Iowa officials investigating boat explosion that injured 3. State officials are investigating a boat explosion in central Iowa that injured 3 people over the Memorial Day weekend. The explosion happened late Monday afternoon on Sailorville Lake, north of Des Moines, the Iowa Department of Natural Resources said Tuesday in a news release. Investigators said gas fumes had accumulated in the engine compartment of the boat and ignited when the boat was started, causing the explosion. There were 8 people aboard the boat at the time of the explosion, officials said. 2 were treated for minor burns at the scene, and 1 passenger was taken to a hospital with serious burns. State officials said boat operators with inboard motors should run the blower system before starting the boat to prevent such explosions and fire. GOP primary for 2nd Congressional District predicted to be close. The June 2nd Republican primary election for Iowa's 2nd Congressional District, by all accounts, is predicted to be a close one. Although 5 candidates will be on the ballot, the primary has turned out to be a 2-person race between political veterans Marionette Miller Meeks and Bobby Schilling. The other candidates are Tim Borchert, Stephen Everly, and Ricky Lee Phillips. Schilling, a businessman who served in Congress representing Illinois' 17th district from 2011 to 2013, lost his bid for a 2nd term to U.S. Representative Sherry Bustos, a Democrat from Moline, in the November 2012 general election. He challenged Bustos again in the November 2014 general election and lost by nearly 22,000 votes. Schilling moved to LeClaire in 2017 and became a resident of Iowa, making him eligible to run for Congress in the 2nd District. Miller Meeks, an ophthalmologist and U.S. Army veteran who retired as a lieutenant colonel, is currently a state senator representing Iowa District 41. The winner of the Republican primary will face Democratic challenger and former District 49 State Senator Rita Hart in the November 3rd general election for the open seat being vacated by Dave Loebsack, a Democrat from Iowa City. Loebsack, first elected in 2006, has announced his retirement from Congress. Schilling has earned influential endorsements from former U.S. Senator Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania and U.S. Representative Jim Jordan, a Republican from Ohio, while Miller Meeks has been endorsed by U.S. Senator Joni Ernst. According to the Federal Election Commission, Miller Meeks has raised 5 times the amount of donations compared to Schilling. The first quarter report ending March 31st shows Miller Meeks with $516,320 in total donations and nearly $400,000 cash on hand. Schilling has raised $99,650 and has $55,000 cash on hand. Schilling announced May 20th that he was recently diagnosed with cancer, saying he will return to the campaign trail after undergoing surgery. "As my family and supporters know, I'm a fighter," Schilling said in a release. "I've been through many challenges in my life, and to be frank, this will be my biggest challenge yet. But I know, with my wife, 10 children, and 13 grandkids behind me, I will be able to overcome this setback. I couldn't be more prepared. I want to assure the voters of the Iowa 2nd District I'm not quitting. I am confident that we will beat this thing and be back at the campaign in very short order." His son, Terry Schilling, is acting as a surrogate to campaign for his father. A letter to the editor. Admiral Franken is the one to beat Senator Ernst. Democrats have 4 candidates to choose from in their Senate primary. The winner will try to defeat Senator Joni Ernst in November. Admiral Mike Franken is the one to get that done. Here's why. I care about policy. I gravitate to candidates who are knowledgeable about issues that affect people in their daily lives, candidates with plans. I care about character. I want to support a candidate with integrity who does not hesitate to say what they believe. I care about temperament. Can this Senate candidate work effectively in an institution that runs on relationships? It takes intellect and political courage to make change in the Senate, as Tom Harkin demonstrated year after year. All of the primary candidates have qualities that would help them be effective in the Senate. But first, the nominee has to win a difficult statewide race by running up the score in rural areas. Candidates running from Des Moines have not been successful in the last few cycles. We need a candidate who appeals to voters in the rural counties as well as city voters. Rob Sand showed us what is possible with the right nominee. Admiral Mike Franken has all of that. He has the character, intellect, and political courage to be a great senator. He has extensive experience with diplomacy from his long and distinguished Navy career. He knows a lot more about policy than Senator Ernst and says what he thinks without hedging. Despite his achievements, he remains grounded in his humble beginnings in tiny Lebanon, Iowa. He is a regular guy, as familiar with hogs, guns, machine shops, and farming as he is with commanding ships. He knows how to talk to people from left to right. He can beat Joni Ernst. Signed, Susan Nelson, Marble Rock. Police say man found dead in Cedar Rapids home was killed. Police in Cedar Rapids have opened a homicide investigation after determining that a man found dead in a home there last week had been shot to death. The victim was identified as Daniel James Spangler, 69, police said Tuesday in a news release. His body was found inside his Cedar Rapids home on Friday morning by an officer who had been sent to check on his welfare, police said. Police initially said Spangler's death was suspicious, but that more investigation would be needed. On Tuesday, police said an autopsy had determined that he had died of a gunshot wound. No arrests have been reported. Brief tornado hits Johnston. Wind causes fire in eastern Iowa. A tornado briefly touched down Monday evening in the Des Moines suburb of Johnston, uprooting trees and damaging traffic signals. The National Weather Service confirmed the tornado Tuesday and noted that another severe storm caused a 67-mile-per-hour wind gust in Newton, east of Des Moines. The wind just picked up, and the next thing I know, the trees fall, Richard Depenning of Johnston told KCCI. We were standing right there, and 15 to 20 seconds later, it was gone. In eastern Iowa, high winds Monday night near Luxembourg lifted the roof off of a barn and crashed it into another building, causing it to collapse onto a hog nursery building. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald reports the nursery building then caught on fire, killing 300 hogs inside. The Weather Service said more severe weather is expected Tuesday, with thunderstorms, heavy rain, and a chance of tornadoes. The rain could lead to localized flooding. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Tuesday, May 26th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
This is Jim Ralston, and I'm with IRIS, Short Take from the Iowa Curiosities. Farmers and their toys, Dyersville, Iowa. The wisdom on bumper stickers is true, and those with the most toys truly do win. Then the National Farm Toy Museum in Dyersville is a winner many times over, with two floors of more than 30,000 farm toys and exhibits, ranging from row after row of common tractors to combines, harvesters, and haulers, all the way down the extensive agricultural machinery lineup to an anhydrous ammonia tanker. The museum is a shrine and miniature to the heavy equipment Iowa farmers fuss over, endlessly fix, periodically live in during planting or harvesting, and tirelessly operate to bring home the grain or the beans that bring home the bacon. And don't let the word toy fool you. The only thing toy-like about these farm toys is that they're built to 1/16th or 1/32nd scale, and don't have internal combustion engines. This is Iowa, after all. Farm machines aren't child's play, even when they're toys. Most of the toys are stunningly accurate, not to mention beautiful. Replicas of tractors or combines with particular makers like John Deere and Case, from particular years, with details accurate down to the windshield wipers. Children play with these toys not only to have fun, they got a vocational education in heavy equipment. Highlights of the museum include an exhibit explaining the notion of scale that features a full-size replica of a John Deere tractor accompanied by a row of successfully smaller scale models, from 1/2 scale all the way down to a realistically looking tractor you can carry in your pocket. Upstairs, look for more tractors and harvesters, enclosed in glass cases, more perhaps than you've ever hoped to see. And though the word toy does technically appear in this museum's name, don't expect much playing around. Tractors, trucks, trailers, and combines, even at 1/32nd or 1/64 scale, are way too wrapped up in Iowa's blood, sweat, and sorrow to be simple objects of play. Don't be surprised if you see some old-timer kicking the tires of a tiny Case combine, wondering how it would hold up harvesting more than 2,000 acres. Or some young, unquietly cussing pocket-sized John Deere because it won't turn over. The National Farm Toy Museum is at the intersection of US 20 and Iowa Highway 136 in Dyersville. Open daily from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., the museum also hosts a number of special events. Exhibits throughout the year, the largest of which is the granddaddy of all farm toy shows, held the first full weekend in November. For more information, call 563-875-2727 or visit www.nationalfarmtoymuseum.com. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities, Quirky Characters, Roadside Oddities, and Other Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.